Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Sysak Stats, Ryanair and United Masters. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. I have with me Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Got to lean forward. Hello!
How are you?
I'm quite tired. That's why I was leaning back while you did the intro, to try and relax a little, get some energy ready for this edition of the podcast.
Where's my coffee gone? That's what I need. There we go. Yeah, well, it's going to be quite a relaxed edition, I think.
It's been quite chilled out so far. Are you now going to slurp your coffee into the microphone?
No, I wouldn't do
that. Is that what we're going to do?
I'm very professional. I'm going to go over here.
Okay. Well, if you're having some coffee, I'm having some coffee.
This is audio gold right here.
I'm back from a UK tour.
Yeah, you have been all over, haven't you?
Belfast, Manchester, Liverpool. UK tour of this United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Next week, the Republic of Ireland.
Wow.
You always struggle, don't you, when... people often say that bands are doing a UK tour, but then there's a Dublin date.
Yeah.
And so that is wrong.
Yes.
And so I say you struggle. What I mean is...
I don't struggle at all.
You're conscientious, is what I mean. That rather than saying it's a UK tour and then sneaking a Dublin date in there, you say... It's a tour of the British Isles, and then you can get away with it.
I have said that in the past, yes. Well, sometimes I just say UK and Ireland. In fact, I say these days, I'd probably say UK and Ireland more often.
It's a bit clunky, though, isn't it?
It is a bit. But you know what happened? It's a few years ago, someone complained quite a lot every time I said a UK tour and there was a Dublin date. So it's been beaten into me.
UK and Ireland or UK ampersand Ireland?
Not ampersand.
No ampersands. People sometimes overuse the ampersand, don't they?
They do.
It should only really appear in company names. Possibly job titles, but nothing else. No ampersands in sentences. Occasionally you get press releases with ampersands.
Well, people just use it as a substitute for and that is not what it is.
No, and in a press release.
Yeah, well, press releases are notoriously badly written, every single one of them.
Every single press release.
I've never had a well-written press release. Ever.
Never.
Not one.
Not one in the entire time that you have been...
No. Writing the only reason I keep doing this job is just to look forward to the day that I see a well-written press release.
And will you then quit?
Yes.
So there's a challenge.
I don't see myself ever quitting.
For all PR people listening, if you want to get rid of Andy Malt from CMU, you write the perfect press release and he will go. What would be perfect about the perfect press release?
The perfect press release would have almost no words in it. I mean, it depends what it's for. If it's for music, it would have a link to a song on SoundCloud or YouTube and nothing else. And
Well, you're making it quite easy for someone to do a perfect press release then.
Yeah, but I've said this before and people don't ever follow my instructions. It's amazing the amount of press releases I get that say, this new track's coming out, would you like to listen to it? And then have no links to the music at all. That happens quite a lot.
Well, perhaps they're predicting your answer's going to be no.
Well, they shouldn't be sending me the press release.
One of the workshops I did on my UK tour this week was the Musicians' Union in the North. Do you know the North?
I'm aware of it.
I'm from the North.
I've heard that.
Yeah. In fact, I was very near Signal Radio territory. We talked about Signal Radio last week. And... how the fact that it ceased to be a good radio station once they got rid of
we had loads of correspondence on that.
Late 1980s jingles.
About that.
Did they?
No.
But yes, quite near Signal Radio territory, but technically, by being in Liverpool, that's Radio City territory, and Manchester is Piccadilly Key 103 territory.
Oh, good old Key 103.
But in order to get there, you have to go through Signal Radio territory. How did I get onto this?
I don't even know.
I was talking about PR in Liverpool. So I was talking about local radio. That's why all the local radio stations are fresh in my mind. Although MFM, which I also mentioned last week, doesn't exist anymore. I think it's become a heart station.
Well, most of them have.
A heart station. Poor Wrexham. Should have a proper radio station, not a heart station. Anyway, I was talking about PR, and so I was offering advice to the artists and musicians in the room about when they're reaching out to the media. And after about 10 minutes of doing that, I did realise I sort of made it sound like all journalists are lazy, irritable, horrible people by saying,
I wouldn't say lazy.
Don't do this, don't do that, oh, I hate it when you do this.
I think lazy is unfair.
Overworked and under-resourced.
You could say that. Just grumpy.
So I had to say, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that journalists are lazy. They're just busy people. And your press release has to stand out, but be easy to process and understand and use.
And don't assume that you're the only person sending me music. That's the thing. You get like a follow-up email within 6 hours. Like, have you listened to this yet? Well, you're going to write about it now. Like, I didn't even know you'd sent the first email, let alone the second one.
The PR workshop now, because we did that survey of music journalists earlier this year, we have all those stats at the end of the PR workshop. Yeah. And so that includes that of the journalists we spoke to earlier this year, I think it is a quarter, or maybe a third, I think it's a quarter, get in excess of 1,000 emails a week. And I mean music PR emails, not all emails aggregated, not spam. 1,000 emails from the music industry every single week.
Yeah.
So if you are emailing a journalist, then that is probably the queue that you are joining.
Yeah, the chance that your email will be read is slim, which is why it's got to be very, very short.
And be persistent without being a pest. That's my line now.
Yeah.
I think I stole that off someone, but I can't remember who. I think I was at an event where someone else said...
They should have been more persistent in letting you know that they gave you that.
Well, if they want to be a pest in the next week and buggers the fact that I've stolen that line from them. But I'm now using it in all of my PR sessions. Be persistent without being a pest. Mm. So anyway, thank you to the MU for hosting those workshops in Liverpool and Manchester, and to Help Musicians Northern Ireland for inviting me to come and talk about streaming... all things streaming, as part of the Sounds of Belfast event that happened earlier this month. So that's what I've been doing. I'm in Ireland this week, as you're listening to the podcast, with IMRO. We do various events with IMRO, which is the performing rights organisation for songwriters and publishers in Ireland. And that's copyright next week. 3 hours of copyright. So that's something for the Irish music industry to look forward to. It'll be good. Come along. If you're an IMRO member, I assume you have to be an IMRO member to get in.
All right.
So if you're not an IMRO member, become an IMRO member and then come to CMU Insights Music Rights Inside and Out at the HQ of IMRO in Dublin. That is happening this week as you're listening to this podcast. So if you've listened to this podcast late in the week, sorry you missed it.
If you're wondering what I've been doing, what I am doing in the coming week, nothing. I went up on the roof of my house yesterday.
Did you?
Yeah.
Just for fun?
Yeah, I've got some scaffolding up, so I went to have a look.
Good view?
Yeah, it's good. Really good view, yeah, but nothing music related.
I hope you are going to be writing some CMU stories in the next week.
I'll decide that later.
Or are you expecting this perfect press release to arrive this very day, and then that'll be it, no more CMU stories?
Hope so.
From the pen of Andy Malt.
Well, we'll see. We can, either you'll be here on your own next week or you won't. We'll see. We can talk about some stories we've already written.
Yeah, let's do that. That is the format, after all.
This week we're going to be talking about Ryanair and YouTube getting in on the ticketing business through some partnerships. And we're going to be talking about a new company called United Masters and TechCrunch's conclusion that it will be the end of the record label. Let's wait and see if that claim is true later on. But now, let's talk about some good old royalties, songwriter and publisher royalties across the globe, which were published by SISAC this week.
Well, stats about the royalties were published by SISAC. You can't actually publish royalties, can you?
No, okay. The stats were published in its annual report that SISAC is the International Confederation of Societies of Authors and Composers, except not in English, so that's why it's SISAC and that didn't make sense. But basically that's an organisation that brings together all the collecting societies that represent songwriters and music publishers around the world, and it publishes its annual Global Collections Report each year. That's just come out, so it tells us what songwriters and publishers were making in 2016, and it's some interesting reading. They were raking it in, apparently, earning more money than ever before, mainly because of streaming, which is what the songwriters and publishers are always saying about streaming, isn't it?
It's how much money it's yeah. bringing in. Yes, so SISAC bring out this annual report. It basically pulls together stats from every single collecting society in the world that represents songwriters and publishers. Confusingly, it also has some collecting societies in its membership that don't do music at all,
yeah.
who represent visual artists or authors and stuff like that.
And those are included in these stats. I assume they're negligible enough that we can just pretend that didn't happen.
The vast majority of the societies in SISAC are music-based, but yes, slightly confusingly, those other stats are in the report too. Because there are lots of collecting societies around the world, it does take them more than half the year to bring it all together. So these are 2016 figures, even though we're getting quite yes. close to the end of 2017 now. And of course, because the streaming business continues to evolve quite rapidly, figures can come out of date quite quickly. But nevertheless, they are a pretty good overview of what was happening on the publishing side of music rights. So this is the money coming in on the song copyright. Obviously, early in the year, around about April, the International Federation of the Phonographic Industry, IFPI, or IFPI, if you prefer, because some people do.
No.
No. Not you.
No one.
But someone does. I met someone the other day who was calling it IFP.
Well, they're wrong.
All right, then. Whatever you say. So in April, IFP, or IFPI, brings out its report that basically aggregates the stats from all of the record industry trade bodies around the world. So that is the recorded music stats, whereas this is the money being brought in on the music publishing side, on the songwriting side. Although, it is always worth mentioning, and I'm sure we mentioned it when we talked about this report a year ago, but I'm going to mention it again, that CISAC brings together stats from the collecting societies who collect royalties for songwriters and publishers. Now, on the publishing side of music, the collecting societies are involved more than they are not.
Yeah.
Whereas on the recording side, collecting societies are only really involved with TV and radio and when music gets played in public at clubs and pubs and cafes. But in more cases on the recording side, record companies do direct deals with the users of the music. The collecting societies are involved a lot on the publishing side. So therefore, these stats in this report do represent a big chunk of what's been happening in music publishing and songwriting in 2016. But it is worth mentioning that not everything goes through the collective licensing system. And so therefore, there are some gaps in these stats. So for example, with sync, other than TV sync, the initial sync deals that are done between the music publishers and the gaming companies and the ad agencies and the movie companies, those are direct deals. And in the US, which is a big market for sync, the initial deals done in TV are done direct as well. So that's a load of money that doesn't go through the collective licensing system and therefore doesn't show up in these stats. And also, when we look at digital, you mentioned that digital, there was quite a lot of growth.
Yes.
So there's some impressive stats coming out of digital in here, but actually these stats are not the complete picture when it comes to streaming, because the big five music publishers, so that's Sony ATV, Warner Chappell, Universal, BMG, Cobalt, for their Anglo-American repertoire, they have direct deals with the digital services, which means that most of the royalties going through those deals actually, for tedious, complicated reasons, a little bit of that money does still flow through the collective licensing system. But a big chunk of it goes directly to the publishers, who then share it with the songwriters. So the digital income that we see in this report is not all of the income that the songwriters and publishers are getting from streaming, which sort of escalates your point, the fact that songwriters are very vocal about the fact that they're simply not seeing enough money coming in from the streaming services. And they may be right in saying that they're not yet seeing enough money. Certainly the songwriters earn a lot less from streaming than the record companies do. But there are some impressive digital stats in this report, and that's not the complete picture. So actually, at large, the song rights business is now starting to see significant sums of money coming in from streaming, by which we really mean Spotify and Apple Music.
Would you like some of those stats?
Give us some of the stats.
Well, let's give you the top line. Overall, the global royalty collections by all the CSAC-affiliated societies topped 9.2 billion euros in 2016, which is a 6% increase year on year.
About a billion of that was not music.
Yes.
So that comes back to your original point, which is, but most of these figures are relating to songs.
So it's more like 8 billion for music. Just under a billion of that was digital income. However, the digital income was up 51.4%. So it's a big increase. And like you say, not the full picture, because the big publishers are not including their income in that.
On Anglo-American repertoire.
On Anglo-American repertoire, which is a large chunk, if not the majority, of their business.
But of course, even though those figures are impressive, certainly the growth in those figures are impressive, the songwriters would continue to argue that it is not enough. And in particular, the old favourite, the reason it's not enough, that's not Spotify's fault, it's not Apple Music's fault, it's big bad YouTube's fault.
Yeah.
And of course, CISAC, just like IFPI, wheeled out the same line. Okay, digital royalties are increasing significantly. That is great. We're really pleased about that. But it should be rising more. And it's not because of YouTube, because of the value gap, because of Safe Harbor. Although, it has to be noted that Jean-Michel Jarre, who, as well as being a musician in his own right, a songwriter in his own right, moonlights as president of CISAC.
Yeah.
And he prefers the term transfer of value.
He's not on message with the rest of the industry, though.
No. So, as far as he's concerned, the problem isn't the value gap, it's the transfer of value. Basically, it's all YouTube's fault. So, a little YouTube dig in these stats as
Which
well.
Which is customary in these reports.
It is just like the record industry's figures.
It used to be piracy, now it's YouTube.
It's that line, everything's great! Oh, but it isn't really because of YouTube. And both IFPI and CISAC always make sure they get that line in there somewhere. In addition to the digital money, because as you say, of the 9 billion or the 8 billion coming through for music, about a billion of that, this is euros we're talking about, is digital. So you might think, well, hang on a second, what is all the other money? And I suppose, well, it's all the other stuff that comes through the collective licensing system. And the big two other revenue streams are TV and radio.
Yeah.
And then live and public performance. So that's either when songs are performed live or when recordings of songs are played in public. And those are the other two big revenue streams that come through the collective licensing system to song rights. And those are more significant than digital, although it's always worth remembering that one of the reasons for that is that when it comes to digital income, way more money goes to the recording rights than the song rights. So the publishers and the songwriters are seeing about a fifth of digital income. Whereas when it comes to things like TV and radio and public performance, usually it's a 50-50 split.
Yeah.
So the money that goes to recordings is the same as the money that goes to songs. Actually, if anything, the songs see more. And when it comes to live performance of songs, by definition, all the money is going to the song rights because there is no recording because it's a live performance. So that is one of the reasons why the other key revenue streams look so much bigger than digital. It doesn't mean that overall more money is coming into the music industry through those uses of music. It's just about the way the money gets shared between the recording rights and the song rights.
Yeah, well, let's have a few regional stats now. Europe, which is the largest overall territory, it accounted for 56.8% of all collections in these stats. And then in Europe, royalties paid for the live and public performance of songs outperformed broadcast for the first time since they've started recording these stats.
Yes, so those two big other revenue streams I talked about, traditionally TV and radio together has brought in more than live and public performance. In Europe, which is the key market for all of this, that has flipped over. You can have your own opinion on that. Is that a sign that live music is still booming?
Or that broadcast is dying.
Or that broadcast is dying. Take your pick.
In the US, where broadcast is complicated, although they do pay song royalties, so it's less complicated than when we talk about record industry royalties. Collections there came to about 1.76 billion euros. And digital income in the US was up 80% year on year. So that was the biggest boost in digital income for the publishing royalties.
Yeah, and while Europe is biggest in terms of regions, the US is biggest in terms of individual countries, which isn't a surprise because the US is the biggest recorded music market too.
But the growing world power of China also gets a mention in these stats.
But only to line up another moan.
Yes, because CISAC reckoned that collections there were about 23 million euros, which is not a lot, really, in the grand scheme of things, for such a large country. But that was partly because CISAC said, and here's the moan, is that only 105 of over 2,000 radio and TV stations in China currently pay any royalties at all for the music they use.
Yeah, so there are various emerging markets which are increasing year on year for music rights owners across the board on both the recording and the song side. And everybody feels that these emerging markets are going to be increasingly key as the years go by. But there are copyright regime issues here that in some markets, particularly in like Asia and Africa, where traditionally copyright hasn't been enforced, even if there is a performing right within the copyright, often it's been very hard to enforce that through the courts. So therefore, lots of radio stations, TV stations, gig venues, etc., go under the radar, pay no royalties at all. So the aim there is, well, various things. Make sure government is making copyright law more rigorous, getting the local collecting societies to then enforce that through the courts, and just putting sort of, I suppose, PR pressure onto broadcasters that they should be playing ball on this and paying some royalties for the music that they use.
Yes, but I would say those stats have just come out. We're now just about to head into 2018. So we can look forward to, in a year's time, finding out what's happening at the moment as we speak. So join us again in a year. I mean, don't wait a year till you listen to your next podcast. But yeah, we'll be back again to look at what money the publishers and songwriters are earning. Yeah, and whether it's getting better.
Join us again in a year when we'll be talking about now. But that's not our fault.
No.
And I'm not blaming CISAC either. There's a lot of data from a lot of societies around the world.
It is a lot of data. Yes.
They've got to crunch and get together. But yeah, so join us in 12 months' time and we'll tell you about now.
Still to come, we're going to talk about the new saviour of the music industry and we'll run through some news in brief. But now let's talk about Ryanair and YouTube getting in on the ticketing business. Not in the same way. I mean, we talked about Amazon getting in on the ticketing business recently, and that was Amazon launching a ticketing company. This is more some partnerships to flog a few tickets. It's more of an added value service than actually properly getting into ticketing, I should say, up front.
Yeah, it has to be said that the headline, Ryanair moves into ticketing, sort of oversold what is happening.
Yeah.
But it is interesting nevertheless. So should we talk about Ryanair first?
Let's.
So Ryanair have done a deal with a company called Coras.
Yep.
I'm assuming that's how you say it. Why not?
Yeah.
So they are a startup who are making it their mission to have tickets sold in unusual places.
Mm.
So rather than just having a ticketing platform like a Ticketmaster or a C-Tickets where you go for your tickets, no, tickets will be sold everywhere you look. And we're not talking here about dodgy touts selling tickets on a Viagogo or on a street corner. We're talking about the legitimate sale of tickets through official partnerships with primary ticketing sellers, but having those tickets on other websites. So I suppose as you go to buy one thing, you might buy a ticket while you're there. And so that's the idea of this Ryanair thing.
Yeah, so it's like, well, you already, when you go and book a flight somewhere, they try to sell you a hotel room and a rental car, and Ryanair will now basically add tickets to that. And initially, they're mainly focusing on West End shows. Currently, the only music event they've got is a James Blunt show next June, which you might want to go to that. I don't know. But they are promising more theatre and live music and sporting events in the near future.
I mean, in some ways, the theatre does make more sense. And you're right, although they were very much, this is music, it's sport, it's theatre. And then you look at the list, it's like, yeah, it's mainly theatre. But that does make sense.
And a lot of stand-up comedy.
But I think...
But it's West End stuff.
The West End stuff makes sense, because obviously the point of this is you go in, you book your flight to London. So this isn't me, because why would I be booking a flight to London?
That'd be daft.
Because that would be London to London. I think you can fly from Gatwick to Heathrow.
I don't know, let's try it.
Somebody once told me, I'm on a little bit of a tangent here.
Are you? I can tell.
That there are two airports in Moscow, a bit like Heathrow and Gatwick. So one's above Moscow, one's below Moscow. But the road system and public transport in Moscow, well, the roads are so busy and the public transport, the trains are so rubbish that they now do flights from one Moscow airport to another Moscow airport. So they could do that from Heathrow to Gatwick, and perhaps I would therefore be buying flights on the Ryanair site. But let's assume I lived in Paris. Then I'd be getting Eurostar, wouldn't I? Bad example.
Yeah.
Let's assume I live in, I don't know, Barcelona, and I'm flying in to London. Then, you, as you say, you buy your flights, and they say, do you want car rental? And you're like, no. And like, do you want a hotel? Like, I already booked my hotel. And they go, do you want insurance? No, I've got insurance. And all sorts of other things they try and sell you. And then now they will say, would you like to go and see a show? And you
and
might.
A lot of people do want to go and see The Lion King when they come over to London for, I don't know why, but they do.
Have you ever seen the stage version
no,
of The Lion King?
Probably very good.
I'm told it's very good.
But it was like, it was when my cousin came over from Australia, it was the thing she was most excited about.
Oh, really?
About.
Surely it's been on in Australia. Anyway.
Not the London one.
Not the London version, that's true. So it does sort of make sense. Okay, yeah, I booked my hotel, booked my car rental. Yeah, I'd like to go and see a show. And that's where the theatre stuff really makes sense, because they can just have all the big West End shows in there permanently. I suppose if you happen to be in London when one of your favourite bands was playing, then why not also book a ticket to go and see the gig?
If you were coming over, especially for that James Blunt show, you could get your plane ticket, hotel room, rental car if you needed it, and the ticket for the show all in one package. So that potentially could be something that people would want.
Perhaps it would be.
But you would have to go to the site to book your flight before you booked your ticket and then go, oh, I could get the ticket here as well.
And you'd have to fly with Ryanair. Which, why wouldn't you?
Well, I wouldn't. Not after last time.
There's quite a lot of reasons why not. Although I still regularly fly Ryanair, despite all of that. But I suppose the point is, this isn't Ryanair expecting anybody to come to their website specifically to buy a ticket to a show or a gig.
No.
It's an upsell. And that's the idea of this startup called Coras, is to do more ticketing upsell. So you're on a website buying one thing and they try and sell you a ticket while you're there, rather than being a standalone ticketing site where you specifically go to get in to a gig or a show.
The Edge is an investor in Coras.
He is.
At a time when it's really good to be seen as an organisation that has investment from U2 in it.
You're alluding to the Paradise Papers
there. I'm sure it's just Bono who's dodgy. I'm sure The Edge is fine.
I'm sure everything he has ever done is totally legit. And I'm sure everything Bono has ever done is totally legit, even if not morally legit. Does that make sense? Whatever. Hey, we're not here to talk about U2 Stax Affairs.
No, we're here to talk about YouTube, which does sound similar.
Does it?
YouTube.
Only if you try really hard does it sound similar. So YouTube is also going into ticketing.
Yes, which you might think it already did, and that would be because it did. Although it's going more directly into ticketing this time. It's done a partnership with Ticketmaster, something it built slightly ambiguously in its blog post about this. It said it was its first ever ticketing partnership with Ticketmaster. So we're not sure if they mean it's their first ever ticketing partnership or the first ever partnership they've done with Ticketmaster. I don't think it matters.
They did once have an alliance with Songkick.
Yes,
didn't
and they had that Bandpage. Well, they bought Bandpage, but you used to be able to put, I'm not sure you can anymore, but you used to be able to put merch and tickets and stuff up under your YouTube videos via Bandpage.
Yeah, at various points ever since YouTube first emerged, really, they have talked about making it more of a direct-to-fan platform. So you go in to watch a video and you watch the video, you enjoy the music, but while you're there, the artist and all their business partners have the opportunity to try and upsell you a ticket or a t-shirt or some other product. And YouTube have talked about doing this at various points, and indeed they have done it at various points. As you say, they acquired Bandpage, which was a sort of a middleman platform that was about allowing artists to get their merch upsell, etc., onto originally various different platforms, and then YouTube bought it, and just YouTube. So YouTube have talked about this at various points. They've done various projects in this space. Although I have to say, it's very rare that you go and look at a YouTube video and there is any upsell whatsoever there. So I don't know whether that's just because artists haven't embraced it or because all of YouTube's past endeavours in this space have been a bit lackluster.
Probably both.
And of course, if you want to be cynical, you could say that this is YouTube trying to shut up its critics in the music community, who obviously constantly bang on about the fact that it doesn't pay enough royalties, just like Jean-Michel Jarre did earlier on in this podcast, if you remember. So it's a way of YouTube to say, all right then, we're not paying you much money when your music actually streams, but hey, we'll help you sell a t-shirt, we'll help you sell a ticket, now shut up.
Yes. Now also, as we've discussed many a time on this show, the problem with any small ticketing startup is they get to a point where they realise that without Ticketmaster involved or Live Nation involved, that really limits the number of tickets you can sell, because Ticketmaster sells tickets for like everything.
Especially in the UK and the US, where they are major players in both the live sector and the ticketing sector, Live Nation and Ticketmaster together. And often Ticketmaster will have not far off 100% of the inventory for lots of shows, either because they are a Live Nation show or they're in a Live Nation venue or they're in another venue that has an exclusive deal with Ticketmaster. And getting access to those tickets can be quite tricky unless you go into partnership and into business with Ticketmaster.
Which YouTube has done. Which I guess makes sense, because obviously YouTube is a massive destination for big pop video. I mean, for all music videos, but you know, you're in the hundreds of millions of plays for big pop videos. So you're getting a lot of people coming and looking at those pages. And if you can sell tickets for those big pop acts underneath the videos, then maybe that's a more successful way of doing it. So that's what they're doing now. You're going to go to your new Justin Bieber video, currently in the US only, and it will say, Justin Bieber's playing this show near you. Would you like to buy a ticket?
Except I'm pretty sure Justin Bieber mainly tours with AEG, and they don't like Ticketmaster because it's owned by Live Nation.
All right, well, he was a bad example.
Yeah,
then.
Bad example.
I mean, at the moment, it's
Jay-Z!
Jay-Z.
He always tours with Live Nation because he's in business with them.
Yes. All right, then you go to your new Jay-Z video. And is he releasing a new video? I suppose it's on any Jay-Z video. You go on and it will say, Jay-Z's playing near you. Would you like to buy a ticket? You say, no, I'll get one of the $6 ones off a secondary site. That's a whole story we haven't discussed.
We haven't even written about that whole story. Go read up on that somewhere else.
Digital Music News is going quite heavy on that since Jay-Z threatened legal action against them for talking about it.
Perhaps it'll become a beef of the week at some point.
Yeah.
We're now alluding to a story that we're not explaining, we've not reported on, and is distracting us heavily from YouTube going into business with Ticketmaster.
What I'm basically saying is YouTube has launched this thing where you can buy tickets through Ticketmaster on its videos, and it will list all ticket dates, but I think it will, like, first of all, it will show you the show near you, and you can drop down and see all of the tour dates. Buy tickets for a show that's not near you if you want. You might want to do that. And initially, it's a few hundred artists in the US. It's going to expand out to all of Ticketmaster's US shows, and eventually worldwide.
And although I put my cynics hat on earlier and said that this was YouTube trying to shut up their critics in the artist community, which it probably is, that said, I think we probably said this on the podcast before as well, there are huge opportunities to do more upselling off all of the streaming platforms. And YouTube have dabbled in this space. Spotify have dabbled in this space. Indeed, they also have a partnership with Ticketmaster that they announced relatively recently.
And there's an artist selling makeup now
on Spotify.
That story
that happened this week. So everyone, I think, agrees that there is potential to use these streaming platforms as they become ever more significant to upsell tickets, t-shirts, merchandise, etc., etc. Although it has to be said, although various platforms have dabbled in this, various artists have dabbled in this, it does always feel when you go into Spotify or you go into YouTube, they aren't really prioritising this. And
it's
so therefore,
this Spotify you only get if you go to the artist's profile
page. Yeah, which you don't really. So you sort of feel that perhaps because ultimately, as far as Spotify and YouTube are concerned, it is a sort of trying to placate artists gesture, because often they're not commercially cut into those upsells.
Yeah.
They're just doing it as an added value for the artists and their business partners. That although they talk about it a lot when they first launch these partnerships, they don't really embrace it as much as they could within the app. Obviously, when Pandora actually bought a ticketing company, Ticketfly, that was interesting because they did have a commercial vested interest to really make that work until they then sold it.
Yeah.
So I think nobody really has properly cracked this yet, but I think it is going to be part of streaming platforms in the future. So the fact that Ticketmaster are now working with both YouTube as well as Spotify is interesting.
Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. We recently did talk about Form 696 in London.
In the context of Ticketmaster's Grime survey.
Yes.
Where people were commenting on this. So this was the bit of licensing paperwork that the Metropolitan Police in London forced promoters to fill out, but only if they were staging an event where people would perform to backing tracks.
Yes, so this has always been talked up as a racist form because it particularly targets grime and other urban and, well, I guess pop as well, but you know, it's grime shows in particular that have struggled with this, that have ended up having shows cancelled because of this form. They already revamped the form to make it slightly less contentious, but it remained so, and it collected information on kind of who the artists are and the expected audience. But then Sadiq Khan recently ordered a review of the form, and the Met Police recently announced that they're scrapping it entirely. They realise that it is terrible.
Yeah, so this form's been around, as you say, a very long time. They reformed it once before when there was a bit of a hoo-ha in the artist community. Then everyone stopped talking about it for a few years. And then in the last couple of years, people have started shouting about it again. And I suppose in the interest of political balance, well, it was the Labour Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, who kickstarted this review that has ultimately led in the form being axed. He did so in response to a letter from Tory Minister Matt Hancock over at the Department of Culture, who basically wrote an open letter to the mayor saying, "We think you should review this." And so he did, and they did, and it is no more.
The Prince Estate's lawsuit against Tidal over what Prince material Tidal did and didn't have the exclusive rights to stream is ongoing. And the latest development in it is that the Prince Estate is now saying that Tidal entirely fabricated a contract to say that they had the exclusive rights to stream his entire catalogue.
Yeah, so Prince definitely did do a deal with Jay-Z.
Yes, and he did it when he was alive and he talked about it, so we know it happened.
So there was definitely a deal between Prince and Jay-Z in regards to having music on Tidal. We know that at least one of his final albums, he definitely gave exclusive rights to Tidal. No one is disputing that. The dispute is over whether or not, as part of that deal, Tidal had exclusive rights to Prince catalogue as well. Tidal said they did have those rights. The Prince Estate say we can't see any paperwork for that. This has been rumbling on for a year now. Obviously, Prince's catalogue in that time has reappeared on other streaming services too. But yes, the latest development in some papers filed with the court recently was the Prince Estate accusing Tidal of fabricating some documents in order to back up their side of the story.
So that rumbles on, and I'm sure will continue to be hilarious. Talking about hilarious things, Brian May got a takedown notice on his Instagram account last week, and he was not happy.
Yes, so he had posted somebody else's photo of him to his Instagram account. We assume that what has happened is that the owner of that photo, the person who had taken that photo, then put a notice into Instagram saying, "That's my photo. He doesn't have my permission. Take it down." Instagram took it down, as they are obliged to under copyright law.
Yep.
They then blocked his account, which I think made him even more annoying.
Yes. So down for 45 minutes, he said in his ranty Instagram post when it came back online.
Yeah, so Brian May then replaced the photo with a screen grab of the notice he'd received from Instagram, and then had a big rant about how, okay, he'd forgotten to credit this photographer, but he usually does. That was just a mistake. And how dare she demand this photo be removed? Even if you do credit a photographer, you still need their permission to post their photos. And okay, on social media, people post other people's photos all the time, but that doesn't stop the photographer having the right to demand that photo be removed, even if you credit them, because that's what copyright law is all about, as Brian May should know.
Yes, because in 2012, he signed a letter, and it wasn't one of those letters where there's hundreds of signees. He was one of, like, maybe 10 people who signed this, amongst Simon Cowell, Elton John, Robert Plant, I think, various kind of big-name rock stars. And they wrote to David Cameron, who was then the Prime Minister before he ruined everything, and they asked him to work to strengthen copyright law to curb online piracy. And really, they were talking up at the time, because this was back years ago when this was still a thing, the Digital Economy Act. I'm sure we all remember part of that was pushing, sending out warning letters to people who infringe copyright, and they were saying you really need to get on and do this.
Yeah, because the gist of the letter was the Digital Economy Act had been passed. This is the old Digital Economy Act. There's been another one more recently. Was passed just before David Cameron became Prime Minister. It had a bunch of anti-piracy measures in there, and then these artists 2 years later were saying all of that got passed by Parliament, but you, the government, you haven't enacted any of that. You haven't put any of that in action. These people are taking on music and putting it on the internet without our permission. Stop that!
Yeah, send them notices telling them to take it down.
Says Brian May, who now moans because another copyright owner, seemingly a fan who took a photo of him, enforced her copyright. And
he was arguing that because he was in the photo, he should be allowed to do what he likes.
Which is not the way it works.
That's not how.
And you know, okay, it's a silly little story. He had a little spat because he was annoyed that his Instagram account got blocked. But it's not a good look. And no. I always think when you're a superstar copyright owner or you're a big Sony Universal, big corporation that owns a lot of copyright, and you're constantly banging on about people protecting your copyright, it's not a good look when you then ignore other people's copyright.
And this is something that happens quite a lot when it comes to photography. It is artists who will talk up people stealing their music who then get into a spat with a photographer over who can and can't use a photo. It's not the first time. Brian May, I would say, was the biggest star to get into one of these arguments, but it's not the first time we've reported on something like this.
So big time copyright owners, if you want respect for your copyright, you need to respect other people's copyright, and especially grassroots creators who are creating just as exciting stuff as you are. So yeah, shut up Brian May, I think is the conclusion.
You can read more on all of those stories and all the stories we're discussing this week at setlistpodcast.com, where you'll find the show notes for this episode and links to all of them. And finally, this week, as promised, the end of record labels. That's, well, I don't know, is that happening?
Quite a bold claim, isn't it?
It's fairly bold.
This is a new startup that has officially launched this week with 70 million of finance backing it, including a chunk of cash from Google, or technically from Google's parent company, Alphabet. But really, what we're focusing on is TechCrunch's slightly over-the-top article explaining this. Because it's an artist services company. We can't quite work out whether it's a new TuneCore or whether it's a new Cobalt Recordings or it's a new BMG Artist Services or it's a new ADA or if it's a new Music Glue or if it's a new brand partnerships thing. It's probably a combination of all of those things. And in that way, it is an interesting proposition. But
it's not reinventing the wheel.
It's not that revolutionary, and it is not the end of record companies. You could say, to an extent, it is competing with record companies, as most of those businesses I just mentioned are also competing with record companies. But yeah, the TechCrunch article about this was very OTT in saying, record companies are dead, they haven't caught up with digital, because, you know, everything's shifted over to streaming, and the labels don't know that. You know, all the labels who are putting all of their music onto streaming services and earning a lot of money back. So labels are screwed, and the future is United Masters, which is the name of this new company, which has been founded by a guy who did work in the record industry in the 90s. He was at Universal, I think at Sony as well, so used to work in the record business and then has had various ventures over the last 10 or 15 years, and then this is his big new proposition.
Yeah, I mean, that TechCrunch article really, I mean, it, in part, it's the article that tech journalists write over and over again without ever actually checking what labels are doing these days. And it also reads a bit like someone who has really believed the hype that one person has told them. I mean, should I read it to you?
Yeah, go on, give us the opening paragraph.
The opening sentence is pretty much all you need, but I'll go the whole paragraph. Record labels are obsolete. Full stop. They haven't kept up as music evolved from selling CDs to streaming songs to promoting concert tickets and merchandise. Labels were meant to help artists generate albums, fame and money, but now anyone can record themselves and no one buys music. So today, that requires being a technology company, combining analytics with hyper-targeted advertising, and the old labels don't have the engineering talent to do it.
So there you go, labels, you're all redundant. It has to be said.
It entirely makes sense.
The Wall Street Journal's write-up on this, which also had some quotes from the people running it and financially backing it, was much more low-key. So I don't know quite how this over-the-top TechCrunch article came about. As far as we can see, this company is going to offer digital distribution to artists, like, you know, all the other digital distribution companies. And then it's going to have some data technology, and the hope is it can pull some data off the streaming platforms, help artists use that data to then reach out to those fans to sell tickets, to sell merchandise, which I suppose alludes to what we were talking about previously with YouTube and its Ticketmaster tie-up. But they will play a more active role in that. And then, once they've got all that data flowing and those direct fan relationships, they can then go to brands, because this guy, Steve Stout, also has a marketing business on the side. So the idea is we help artists with their distribution, we then help them sell merch and stuff direct, and then we can use all this data to try and get some brands involved.
We did just say that no one's really doing that properly yet.
I think that's the point. Nothing here is particularly revolutionary or new, in that loads of people, including people at record companies and major record companies, have been talking about the need to do this for years now. And quite a few people did note that Leo Cohen, who obviously now is in charge of music at Big Bad YouTube, but between being at Warner Music and going over to YouTube, he set up that business 300, which is still going, but he's not actively involved in it anymore. And a lot of what he said when he set up 300 is exactly the same as what these people are saying now. But yes, it is true that there are opportunities here which people have been talking about for a long time. People have been dabbling. Some people are doing some interesting stuff in this space. But it does feel that nobody has yet completely capitalized on these opportunities. And perhaps these guys, with their technical know-how, will be innovators in this space. Although the basic concept in itself isn't that revolutionary. And even if it does all work, it has to be said that record companies still have a role to play, and major record companies have a role to play. And if you want to understand how all of these things fit together, well, you should read the Deals Guide that the Music Managers Forum published, produced by us here at CMU Insights. But I think what is interesting about this and all of the other companies that we've referenced here is what is new is that in 2017, as an artist, when you're sort of growing your business and you need help with distribution and marketing and finance, which are the three things that record companies traditionally brought to the table and continue to bring to the table. But it is true, as an artist, and this is why managers need to be aware of this as well, hence MMF publishing this guide, is there is now a greater choice of business partners you can work with on getting your content out there, marketing both your content and your artist brand, and raising money.
And that's definitely a good thing.
It is.
Because perhaps, the rise of the artist service company, not every artist needs a traditional label to do what they want to do, and they just kind of pick and choose the different services from an artist service or a label services company. And that's great. And, you know, or you can just self-release stuff through TuneCore or whatever, Ditto Music. It's all great. Choice is brilliant.
And because there are those new companies doing that, the old record companies now are doing much more flexible deals. You want this, you don't want that. What it does mean is, as a manager and as an artist and as the lawyers working with artist and manager, choice is a great thing and you should have that choice, although now you've got to make a choice. And you've got to decide, well, which of these companies is right for us? What kind of deal do we want with those companies? And that's what the Deals Guide is there to help provide a little bit of advice on that. And one of the things this new company, United Masters, they were really talking up that. Yes, there are other people doing what we're doing already, but we're going to be super flexible and maybe we'll charge a fee and then the artist gets all the money, or maybe we'll take a commission on the streaming royalties, or maybe we'll take a commission on the tickets down the line. And so we're open to all sorts of different deals, although if they are ultimately hoping to make their money on tickets down the line, that brings us back to the Ticketmaster challenge you referenced earlier, which is, I hope they're aware that anyone who is hoping at some point they'll get control of ticketing and that's where all the money will be, have to remember that certainly in many of the big markets, the tickets generally seem to end up with Ticketmaster. And that's a very hard company to compete with. Or indeed, obviously, the other big ticketing companies in Europe, like C-Tickets and Eventim. The ticketing sector is quite sewn up. So hoping to ultimately get a load of cash out of that might be tricky. But nevertheless, it is an interesting proposition. But let's reaffirm, record companies are not, for this week at least, obsolete.
No, although I'm sure we can expect to see Steve Stout on the front cover of Wired as Jesus.
The saviour.
Like they once did with Daniel Ek. That was a great I've still got that somewhere. Daniel Ek is Jesus and the saviour of music.
And then Cobalt was also the saviour of music.
Yes, although they didn't quite go so OTT with the front cover of the article was quite OTT, but the cover was less so than presenting Daniel Ek as Jesus.
So we look forward to seeing that article.
That's all we've got time for this week. Tell someone about the show. Any way you see fit, just try to get more people to listen, really. That's all I'm asking of you. You could follow us on that social media they have now that the kids like. Or you could even email us your questions, which is the thing we used to ask and we don't do anymore.
No.
We haven't answered a listener question for a while. If you've got a question about the music industry that might be fun for us to find out about, why don't you email it over, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk, and we'll see what we can do for you. The show was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It's produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, you can go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at unique facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.